Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to tonight's edition of Jump Right In, a production of 1111 Broadcasting. I've got one thing to say today. Brr! It is cold in Florida. I feel so betrayed when Florida does this. It makes me seriously think about moving to the equator. But then you turn right around, and it's back to 70 tomorrow. So go figure, that's Florida for you. This is Splash, and my pond is open. We have a great show last night. We explored Liz Warren and my opinion that her ethics are still intact. Little chinks, but still intact. You Smurfs had better get her to run. We blasted Obama for his wholesale purchase of the Latino vote with his amnesty bonuses paid for with our tax dollars. And then there are actually U.S. citizens that are renouncing their citizenship over tax concerns to the tune of 3,500 people per year. That's up 10 times from Obama's predecessor. I don't know who that was, but whoever it was. Lots of good stuff in last night's episode of Jump Right In. So if you missed it, go to our blog, 1111broadcasting.com, and listen to the archive podcast. Of course, you can check out any and all of the past episodes of Jump Right In. That's at our blog site, of course, 1111broadcasting.com. Like us on Facebook at 1111broadcasting, and you can listen to a show right there on our Facebook page. Now, tonight, we're going to talk more about Obama's amnesty program and how it was just stopped in its tracks, at least temporarily. And you're not going to believe this. This time it really is all George Bush's fault. And then there is Jeb Bush starting his necessary campaign to distinguish himself from his brother, especially with regards to foreign policy. And we have to talk about this new research on couch potatoes, so we'll get into that. And Obama said that our combat mission, of course, was over in Afghanistan at the end of last year. So why are we stepping up our combat missions, especially during the low and slow time of the year for insurgency uprising? We will talk about that. And did you see that explosion of that oil tanker train in West Virginia? Man, was it pretty. Thank goodness nobody was killed, but that does have some interesting ramifications for domestic oil and says some interesting things about Obama and the greenies. Anyway, so much to cover, so little time. The number to call, 215-383-5730. That's 215-383-5730, and I encourage you to jump right in. Wade carefully if you must, but remember, in my pond, everyone swims at their own risk. And we'll be here for the next hour doing the thing I love to do most, talking smack about politics. If you want to chime in, just give us a call. I promise that I will definitely bite, but it'll be a nice little nibble and you'll love it. Now, you can jump right into the show chat room. Tonight, you'll need a free login from Blog Talk Radio. It takes less than a minute. Put in your email address, pick a screen name and a password, and voila, you can jump right into the chat room, pick on me, pick on people, you know, whatever. But if you want to participate in the show, put your stamp on tonight's episode, then by all means, wade into my pond. Dial up the number right there at the top of your show page, 215-383-5730. That's 215-383-5730. And I would love to talk to you. Put me to the test. It'll be your time to shine. Now, before we get into tonight's show, let me tell you about Choice Mattress and Furniture. When it comes to mattresses and bedding, David Ritter and the staff at Choice Mattress know their stuff. I took my whole family to Choice Mattress. Everything was considered, from our weight to our height, our age, the way that each of us sleeps. The right mattress was personally selected for each of us. Now my whole family sleeps in great comfort all night long on beds from Choice Mattress, and yours can too. Every mattress carried by Choice Mattress comes with a 5, 10, or even 15-year warranty. That's 100% full replacement warranty, not the prorated limited warranties like other stores. Chances are, if you bought a bed from in the Daytona Beach area in the last 20 years, and you bought it from David, with over 20 years of experience, David knows beds. And you should see all the other fine lines of furniture Choice Mattress has for every room in your home. So go see David and the fine folks at Choice Mattress and Furniture, located on the corner of LPGA and North Nova Road, 1501 North Nova Road in Holly Hill. Or you can give them a call, 386-226-BEDS. That's 386-226-2337. Choice Mattress, simply the best choice that you can make in your sleep. Now, folks, every president meets his match. For Obama, it wasn't the new and overwhelmingly Elmo Congress, but rather a judge in Texas, appointed by George W. Bush. So this time, it really is all George Bush's fault. The AP is reporting that the Obama administration put the new deportation relief program, otherwise known as amnesty, on hold Tuesday on the eve of its launch, complying reluctantly with a federal judge's order that roiled immigrant communities nationwide and seemed to harden an already tense stalemate on Capitol Hill. Now, President Barack Obama met with a group of dreamers in the Oval Office of the White House in Washington this past February 4th. The president accuses opponents of his immigration action of failing to think about the human consequences. The president spoke during an Oval Office meeting Wednesday with six of the young immigrants who would be subject to eventual deportation under a bill passed by the House. The legislation would overturn, of course, Obama's executive actions, limiting deportation for millions here illegally and giving them the ability to work. Now, I mean, I don't know what the big deal is. He's going to veto it anyway, so I don't know why he's being all dramatic. But an executive order, by the way, that even many of his own Smurfs urged him not to issue. But I want to talk about these human consequences that Obama claims that his opposition is not considering. What happens to these young immigrants if Obama's amnesty program is stayed by the courts or rolled back by Congress? That's right. Nothing. They were not being deported yesterday, and they won't be deported tomorrow, and they might not even be deported eventually. The Smurfs make it sound like these 4 million people would be booted right over the border as soon as Obama's order is reversed, and of course that's ridiculous. The Smurfs and even Obama make it sound like children are going to be yanked from their mother's arms and left in the streets to fend for themselves while their parents are given the boot. This is nothing but nonsense. And just so you know, even if they were sent back to Mexico, the children would go with them, or they could stay here with their many legal relatives, aunts, uncles, grandparents, cousins, sisters, friends. As I said on last night's show, Mexican families are huge, and they have no problem cramming another few people into their already crammed domiciles. It is their culture. They are used to it. Now, President Barack Obama promised, by the way, this is from an AP story by Eric Werner and Jim Cahunian. So just so you know, I want to quote the source, but a lot of this information is from that story on the AP. President Barack Obama promised an appeal and predicted that he'd prevail. But for tens of thousands of immigrants in line to begin applying Wednesday for work permits and deportation stays under his directives, their plans were canceled, at least temporarily. Now, talking to reporters in the Oval Office, Obama said that he disagreed with the ruling of the U.S. District Judge Andrew Hanen, of Texas that the administration had exceeded its authority. But he said that for now, he must abide by it. Yep, you must. And it's all Bush's fault. We're not going to disregard the federal court ruling, Obama said. And that's because you can't. You can't. It's the courts. Obama added that the administration officials would continue to prepare to roll out the program. I think the law is on our side and history is on our side, he said. What else is he going to say? We broke the law and we got caught? And what history is he talking about, that illegal aliens have always crossed our border illegally? That history? That's the history that's on his side? Please. On Capitol Hill, the Homeland Security Department stood 10 days away from losing funding. But Hayden's ruling made a compromise on that dispute look even more distant than ever. Republicans are blocking funding for the agency unless Democrats agree to cancel Obama's immigration orders, and they seized on the ruling as validation for their position. And that's because that's what it is. It is indeed validation by the courts. It is now two branches of the government against one. Congress saying, and the court saying, So Congress must reassert its waning power. We must reestablish the constitutional principles that people's representatives control the purse. That was said by Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama, the leading immigration hardliner. So, you know, nowadays, if you follow the law, you're a hardliner. So the Elmos haven't budged. Now, yes, the Senate Democrats, who have been blocking a House-passed bill that would fund the department but also undo Obama's actions, said the ruling from Hayden did nothing to budge them. Yeah. Ooh, is this silly ruling anyway? Smurfs only respond positively to court rulings when they go their way. Then suddenly it's the law of the land. And so the Smurfs, they haven't budged. Democrats remain united in our belief that the funding for the Department of Homeland Security should not be used as ransom by Republicans, period, said Chuck Schumer of New York. Now, you silly little misguided Smurfs. Immigration is under the jurisdiction of the Department of Homeland Security. This is where the funding is dealt with, in that department's budget. That's not holding it hostage. That is Congress, which is constitutionally in charge of appropriations, saying that they will pay for this, but they will not pay for that. The agency's $40 billion budget runs out on February 27th. Everybody knows that. And with Congress now in recess, lawmakers will have only a couple of days to reach an agreement once they return to Washington next week. Now, one possibility, of course, is a short-term extension of current funding levels, but House Speaker John Boehner said over the weekend that the House has done its job, and he would certainly let a shutdown occur if the Senate didn't act. So the Elmos haven't budged. Let me remind you, folks, 87% of Homeland Security personnel are considered essential. They're going to work whether there's a shutdown or not. And they're going to be paid, whether they're paid now or whether they're back paid after these guys work this all out. Absolutely no threat to the security of the United States of America by a shutdown. So when they tell you that, they're just trying to scare you. It doesn't matter which side, because Republicans have put coffins outside the doors of Democrats voting or filibustering this bill, and Democrats are pointing their fingers right back at the Elmos. So if the political impasse seemed severe, so were the implications for millions of immigrants in this country illegally. Pay attention to how many times they use this word, illegal, illegally. The implications for millions of immigrants in the country illegally who have cheered Obama's executive directives in the face of congressional inaction. That's because illegal aliens don't care about our Constitution either. Their implications should seem severe. They're breaking the law. We feel powerless, but not defeated. Sure that it will all work out. That's 46-year-old Claudia Ramon, a native of Colombia. She said at a rally in Houston, one of a dozen nationwide, where immigrants and their advocates vowed to continue the preparations under Obama's programs. You feel powerless, because you are powerless, because you are illegal. You want power? Go back to Colombia. Here in America, you're illegal and therefore powerless. So Obama's directives would make more than 4 million immigrants in the United States illegally eligible for that are here in the United States illegally eligible for a 3-year deportation stays and work permits. Most of those people who have been in the country for more than 5 years and have children who are U.S. citizens or legal permanent residents. Applications for the first phase were to begin on Wednesday, the day after this court ruling was made, but that's when as many as 300,000 immigrants brought illegally to the country as children could begin applying for an expansion of Obama's 2012 program aimed at younger immigrants known as Dreamers. They may be Dreamers, but they are also illegal. There is just no way around that word. The article can't avoid the word illegal, and it used that word at least a dozen times, this AP article, just this one article. They cannot avoid that word. Now, I understand the desire for a better life. What American doesn't dream about a better life? What immigrants here legally don't dream about a better life? We are all dreamers, but Obama's dreamers are illegal. I want lots of money, but robbing a bank is illegal. I love to dine out at fine restaurants, but walking out on the check is illegal. I want to set stuff on fire because I love fire. But arson is illegal. Just like there's a right way to get money, dine out, and enjoy a good fire, there is also a right way to come to America. Illegally crossing our borders is the wrong way, and it is illegal. And every one of Obama's dreamers are illegal. They cannot escape this fact. But here's their plan. Advocates pledge to redouble their efforts to sign up as many people as possible. Listen to Marielena Hinnikapi, Executive Director of National Immigration Law Center. It's extremely important for the community to understand that from a legal perspective, it is on solid legal footing. Listen to this idiot twice use the word legal to describe that which is illegal. And she continues, and actually, the larger number of people who come forward to apply, the more likely that we can protect this expansion. In other words, the more likely they are to be able to make this stick if they get more people to sign up. Everyone, be ready to sign up en masse. This is exactly why Judge Andrew Hennen, a WMF appointee, issued his injunction. Even the Smurfs know that if they can just get this executive order implemented and get as many people as possible to sign up, that it will be, as the judge said in his ruling, impossible to reverse. That is what they mean when they say, if we can get so many people to apply, then we are more likely to protect this expansion. So that is the Smurfs' philosophy. Make illegal activity impossible to reverse. Hannon's, you know what? I mean, I disagree with the Elmos on a lot of things, but they are on the right side on this issue. Hannon's, and quite frankly, it's worth sacrificing the Latino vote to make that happen. Hannon's ruling late Monday night, so really Tuesday, in the case brought by 26 states led by Texas, said that Obama and his Homeland Security Department lacked the authority to take the actions that they did. No statute gives the Department of Homeland Security the discretion it is trying to exercise here, wrote Hannon. And he issued a stay blocking the action from taking effect. His order was not a big surprise from a Republican-appointed judge who has shown a hard line on border issues. Now, again, they're describing abiding by the law, hard line. These are not border issues. It is illegal to cross the U.S. border except through the legalized channels. This is not a border issue. It is immigration law. It is not a hardline approach. It is enforcement of the law. Now, the executive branch is supposed to enforce the law. But here we have a judge having to enforce the law because Obama won't. In fact, Obama defies it. Now, of course, Obama and his Smurfs want to ignore that law for the reasons I stated on last night's show. There is a big payoff in tax credits coming to the Latino community if they can just get these illegals signed up and arm them with real, genuine, live Social Security cards. This is not so much deportation relief as it is one great big wholesale purchase of votes, Latino votes. The Obama administration could seek a stay on Hannon's order in addition to appealing to the 5th U.S. Circuit of Appeals in New Orleans. Attorney General Eric Holder said Tuesday that the Justice Department was deciding its next move. He said, "I've always expected that this is a matter that will ultimately be decided by the higher court, if not the Supreme Court, then a federal court of appeals." The drama played out with the 2016 presidential contest just getting underway and candidates of both parties eager to win over Latino voters. One potential Republican candidate, Jeb Bush, weighed in on, with his posts on his Facebook page, declaring that Obama had overstepped his authority and hurt the efforts towards a common-sense immigration solution. Except, see, the Smurfs don't want a common-sense immigration solution here. They want a payoff for the Latino community, so the legal Latinos will vote for them because they showered the household in which the illegal aliens live, their household, with money, with payoffs, with tax credits, because of legitimized Social Security cards. And now more than ever, we need President Barack Obama, this is Jeb Bush, to work with Congress to secure the border, and fix our broken immigration problems. Now, the Latino community doesn't want the border fixed. They want these people coming over. They want them coming over, hiding long enough so that they can get this kind of amnesty and these kinds of monetary benefits. I'm telling you, folks, Jeb will win over some Latinos. He did it here in Florida. He will do it in the general election. Oh, the Smurfs will win a majority of the Latino vote. But if Jeb wins the Elmo nomination, the Smurfs will not get 70% of the Latino vote like they did in this last election, but they will get the majority. Mark my word, you heard it here. Jeb will help the Elmos on the Latino vote. And speaking of Jeb, he launched his oh-so-necessary I'm Not My Brother campaign yesterday. Where'd you go, Jeb? There you are. Jeb Bush says that he is his own man. This is from a story on Politico. He's his own man in the White House on foreign policy. Speaking to the Chicago Council on Global Affairs for his first major address on overseas issues since announcing that he was actively exploring a presidential bid in December, the former Florida governor is expected to draw a line between himself and his father, firmly in the realist camp, and his brother, whose neoconservative instincts and unpopular war in Iraq nearly drove him from office. They're referring to, of course, to the almost lost reelection to that bonehead Kerry that we are so lucky never became president. Excerpts suggest that Jeb Bush is well within the GOP mainstream in seeing the U.S. with a robust global presence whose strength encourages peace, and acknowledges that his family's long and complicated history on foreign policy. He says, "I recognize," this is in his speech, "I recognize as a result my views will often be held up in comparison to theirs, even in contrast to theirs. I love my father and my brother. I admire their service to the nation, and the difficult decisions that they had to make. Now, this is truly the only hurdle Jeb Bush has. You know, I mean, they're going to debate about all kinds of things, about this issue and that issue, but this is really the issue here, that he is not his brother. Forget about his father, that he is not his brother. And how hard will it be to draw up a list of famous brothers that are so completely different from one another and then let them assume that W was the bad brother while Jeb was the good one? Jimmy Carter had a loser brother. Okay, Jimmy was a loser. So that's probably not the best example. How about the Koch brothers? Okay, bad example again. Ah, I got it. Cain and Abel. No, seriously. Bill Clinton's half-brother Roger had a code name in the inner circle at the White House. They called him the Headache. LPJ had to put his brother Sam under Secret Service surveillance because he loved to talk to the press when he was drunk. Billy Carter was called the brother of all brothers. Don Nixon got a loan for his failing burger drive-ins from Howard Hughes and didn't pay it back. When the story broke, people wondered why a defense contractor like Howard Hughes was suddenly interested in a president's brother's burger chain. Incidentally, Hillary has two brothers who were both a pain in Bill Clinton's ass when he was president. They hatched a $118 million business plan to process and import hazelnuts from the Republic of Georgia. Now, there was a slight little hitch here. The brother's key connection in Georgia was the major political rival of Georgia's president. Bill and Hillary had to work in tandem with the National Security Advisor Sandy Berger to talk the brothers out of their hazelnut empire. Hazelnut empire. So, you see, suddenly W doesn't look like such a bad brother. At least he was president instead of just a burden to a president. Why couldn't they all just be like the Blues Brothers? Elwood and Jake, the coolest brothers ever. Anyway, Jeb said, "But I am my own man, and my views are shaped by my own thinking and my own experiences. Each president learns from those who came before, their principles, their adjustments. One thing we know is this. Every president inherits a changing world and changing circumstances." Now, it's unclear whether Bush would ultimately fall more in line with his pragmatic thinking of his father or more aggressive approach of his brother, whose invasion of Iraq in 2003 set the tone for the rest of his presidency. Jeb has defended his brother's actions on multiple occasions, and he has reportedly turned to a few of his old advisors on foreign affairs as well. Now, many of these advisors come from the past GOP administrations, including ones from his father and from his brother and from Ronald Reagan, according to reports by Reuters. Two of his brother's former Department of Homeland Security secretaries, Tom Ridge and Michael Chertoff, are on the list. Also, Paul Wolfowitz, who outlined the U.S. case to go to war in Iraq for his brother. Former CIA directors, Michael Hayden and Porter Goss. Former National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley, Megan O'Sullivan, a Department of National Security Advisor with the specialization in Iraq, and of course James Baker, who served under Bush's father and Reagan as Secretary of State and Chief of Staff. So Bush has some familiar faces there, which is not uncommon for presidents of either side of the Elmo or Smurf spectrum. Now, Bush also attacked the current White House's as inconsistent and decisive international approach, much of which occurred, lest we forget, under a Hillary Clinton State Department. Jeb urged the need for better leadership and for President Barack Obama to get leaders from both parties together to boost defense spending. The great irony of Obama's presidency is this. Someone who came to office promising greater engagement with the world and has left America less influential in the world. Those are Jeb Bush's words. The administration draws red lines and then erases them. In reference to Barack Obama's infamous about-face on Syria's use of chemical weapons, with grandiosity, they announce reset and disengage. Hashtag campaigns replace actual diplomacy and engagement. Personal diplomacy and maturity is replaced by leaks and personal disparagement. These are some pretty tough words for somebody if they're not going to be running for president. So clearly, that's what Jeb Bush is doing. He's setting the stage that it is time for a change. And isn't that always what happens when one party takes over from another, or is trying to take over for another? Bush could face a tougher challenge from fellow Republican Rand Paul, whose wariness on overseas military action has distinguished himself from other potential 2016 candidates. A tough challenge. No, he won't. No challenge at all. Rand Paul might not even run now. For who knows? He knows he won't win, so why risk his Senate seat? Just like Ron Paul. I mean, this whole notion of isolationism is just not gonna occur. Now, on the Democratic side, frontrunner Hillary Clinton's 2002 Senate vote to authorize the Iraq War ultimately hurt her against Barack Obama in 2008. She, of course, wrote that she got it wrong in her recent memoir, Hard Choices. And you see, that negates the whole W factor right there. If Hillary runs, of course, which is still, I still maintain that she won't, but what's she going to do? Admit that she was dumb enough to believe a president that her and most of her party thought of as dumb? I mean, this is just, you know, this will negate the whole W factor right there. Almost like Romney negated the Obamacare factor, Hillary will negate the Jeb is his brother factor. It will just go without saying. Now, during a question and answer session after his speech, Jeb acknowledged that mistakes were made under his brother's watch, saying that intelligence about Saddam's possession of weapons of mass destruction was not accurate, and that the U.S. initially failed to create an environment of security in the country after they removed Saddam from power. So he's separating himself from the number one issue of his brother's presidency, all the while highlighting the one thing that his brother got right, as he praised his brother's decision to surge troops into Iraq in 2007, which added roughly 20,000 troops, I thought it was 40,000, but maybe it was 20,000 troops, to American forces in the country in an effort to improve security. He called it one of the most historic acts of courage politically of any president. Now, I don't know about most historic act, but I do know this, that it worked. The surge was hugely successful, Jeb said, and it created a fragile but more stable situation in Iraq that President Barack Obama could have built on during his term in office. I'm telling you, folks, Jeb is conservative enough to win the nomination of the Elmo Party, but centered enough to win the general. You Smurfs had better run. Don't walk. Run. And get Liz Warren to run, or you can just hang it. I want to jump overseas for a bit, but before I do, let me remind you that when it comes to mattresses and bedding, David Ritter and the staff at Choice Mattress and Furniture know their stuff. My whole family is now sleeping on mattresses. My whole family is now sleeping in beds from Choice Mattress, and you cannot say enough about the benefits of a great night's sleep on the mattress chosen especially for you. Every mattress carried by Mattress Choice comes with a 5, 10, or even 15-year, 100% full replacement warranty. Not one of those prorated limited warranties like other stores. With over 20 years of experience, David and the folks at Choice Mattress know their stuff. And you should see all the other fine lines of furniture that they have for every room in your house. So go see the folks at the fine folks at Choice Mattress and Furniture, located at 1501 North Nova Road in Holly Hill. And of course, if you have any questions, just give them a call, 386-226-BEDS. That's 386-226-2337. Choice Mattress, simply the best choice that you can make in your sleep. Now, moving overseas, as I promised, U.S. Special Forces Soldiers and their Afghan allies have undertaken an increasing number of night raids targeted at Taliban and Al-Qaeda militants, despite Washington formally declaring an end to combat operations last year, according to a published report. Now, seriously, the U.S. combat mission is over. These aren't enduring combat offensive operations. So they don't count, my bad. Remember, that's what Obama is asking for in his authorization to wage war, what he's asking for from Congress. He's promising no enduring combat offensive mission operations. So you're starting to get a glimpse of what we might be talking about here when we talk about what Obama means by combat missions with our troops that he puts on the ground there all over the Middle East. The New York Times reports that increased raids are partially the result of intelligence seized in October of last year when the U.S. and Afghan commandos came upon laptop computers with files detailing terror operations in Afghanistan. Now, and neighboring Pakistan. Military officials tell the paper that the information that the files could be as significant as what was found on the computers in Osama bin Laden's Pakistan compound after the terror leader was killed by Navy SEALs in 2011. But we're not done in Afghanistan, or are we supposed to be? The officials also said that another factor playing a role is in the increased raids were loosened restrictions on nighttime operations put in place by the new Afghan president, Ashraf Ghani. Now, Ghani has previously called for a slower withdrawal of U.S. troops from his country. The current plan calls for the U.S. to go from about 10,800 troops there now to 5,500 by the end of the year. So let me get this straight. We declare an end to combat operations, but now that we have loosened restrictions on nighttime operations, we step it up? Is this the kind of thing that Jeb was talking about when he called Obama inconsistent and indecisive? Now, mind you, I don't disagree with going after these people, but this is what we're talking about, stated policy versus what you actually do and how it might change on a dime. Now, the U.S. and its NATO allies formally announced the end to their combat mission in Afghanistan in December and trumpeted the withdrawal of most combat troops. However, under the terms of security agreement with Afghan government, just over 13,000 troops, most of them American, were to stay on in an advisory role. Now, folks, I'm getting this, of course, from a Fox News story, so take that as you wish, but I checked out all this stuff and it's very accurate. Oh, I don't know why I have to give that qualification, but when you're a conservative talk show host and you do occasionally quote Fox News, which I try not to do, that's just where I found this particular story. For some reason, you just have to do that. Just a little disclaimer there. But so these were to stay in an advisory role. 13,000 troops, most of them in America, were to stay in an advisory role. Now, I thought, according to Obama, that troops in an advisory role were not combat troops. Didn't Obama send troops to Iraq, about 3,500 of them, in advisory roles, swearing that they did not have combat mission? So now they are combat troops. Of course, I knew it all along. I said so right here on this show back in December. Now, however, Americans and Afghans officials tell the Times that the U.S. troops are taking a lead role in the latest counterterror raids and not merely going along as advisors. And that's because they are combat troops. Ya wombats. It's all in the shadows now, said a former Afghan security official. To the New York Times. The official war for the Americans, the part of the war that you could go see, that's over. It's only the secret war that's still going, but it's going hard. So now we have a secret war with secret advisors that are on the offensive, not as advisors, but in combat, in the lead role. You see, Obama doesn't want to be seen as the dude that continued the wars. He wants to be the one that ended them. So now he's doing everything. Here's that old transparency again. Troops in Iraq, troops in Afghanistan, and currently he's asking for the authorization to put troops everywhere as long as they don't conduct enduring combat offensive missions. News of the increased raids comes one day after a top U.S. military commander in Afghanistan told the Senate Armed Service Committee that he wants greater flexibility in how quickly he pulls troops out of Afghanistan and where he can position them around the country in the coming months. General John Campbell said that by keeping more than 5,500 troops in Afghanistan through the end of the year, Campbell would be able to maintain forces in other locations around the country, both training the Afghan forces and providing support for more counterterrorism missions. And by support, he means lead role, because that's what's happening. I'm particularly concerned about the summer of 2015, Campbell said. The Afghans, this is the very first fighting season completely on their own. He's concerned. They won't survive. They will tuck tail and run, just like the Iraqis did, just like the Yemenis did. It is their nature. The terrorists they are expected to fight are just too damn terrifying. Anyway, enough about war. I want to talk about domestic politics because there's a couple of things there that I want to talk some smack about. And so I will. Now check out this headline from Huffington Post. I used to comment over on Huffington Post all the time. And so I see them do this all the time. So when I went and I got this story from there, I thought, that's so Huffington Post. Conservatives cheer. Research saying benefits helped the economy. Now, had this research been that supported a liberal point of view, the headline would have started with research. In other words, research says cuts to unemployment benefits hurt the economy. It wouldn't have said liberals cheer. Research saying cuts to unemployment benefits hurt the economy. The liberals' cheer part would have been left out, omitted, not even thought of. But this is HuffPo. Just about the most liberal, regressive news outlet out there today. So since the research supports a conservative point of view, then they have to discredit the research with conservatives' cheer. Anyway, the need to point that out. On with the story, but HuffPo does really ham this up. Watch. Listen. So the title of the article, Conservatives Cheer. So we're going to leave that out for the moment. Research says cuts to unemployment benefits helped the economy. We're talking about the federal extensions here. It helped the economy. A new research paper suggests. No, it doesn't suggest. It concludes. Anyway, I don't want to change HuffPo's words. So, a new research paper suggests Congress helped the economy to the tune of nearly 2 million jobs when lawmakers killed long-term unemployment benefits at the end of 2013. The paper by economist Marcus Hagedorn, Lori Manofsky, and Kurt Mittman is a boon to congressional. Look at the words they use. It's a boon to congressional Republicans who insist the benefits not be renewed. The Wall Street Journal editorial board trumpeted the findings, and the House Ways and Means Committee, chaired by Representative Paul Ryan of Wisconsin, touted the paper on its blog. But while the study might help the GOP take credit for an improving economy, the story isn't quite so simple, as several other recent studies have found the long-term benefits were holding back workers. And they weren't holding back workers. That's what they were talking about before. Well, this research seems to indicate otherwise. Anyway, the new paper says that the benefits cut led to 1.8 million additional jobs last year. 1.8 million. 1.8 million. So if we take out our little calculator here, $3 calculator made in China, 1.8 million divided by 12 is 150,000 of the 240,000 or so jobs created last year. So if we minus 246,000, that means that Obama was only responsible for 96,000 jobs per month. Wow. That hurts, don't it? Almost 1 million of these jobs were filled by workers from out of the labor force who would not have participated in the labor market had benefit extensions been reauthorized, the authors of the paper wrote. They reached their conclusion. See, they use the word conclusion here. Can't avoid it. It is a conclusion. They reached their conclusion by comparing the 2014 employment growth of adjacent counties in separate states since the federal unemployment insurance program that expired in December 2013 offered different durations of benefits depending on a state's unemployment rate, and that was true. Using Labor Department data, the paper found that the counties in states that lost out on more weeks of benefits saw higher job growth. So when you had less benefits, it resulted in higher job growth. In other words, they were better off without the benefits. The finding is contrary to the predictions from the Obama administration and the Congressional Budget Office, which assumed keeping the extended unemployment compensation through 2014 would boost the economy. See, and there's the difference between predictions or assumptions and actual research. This is why HuffPo above uses the word suggests instead of concludes with regards to this research. You can say it all you want, but employed people make more money than unemployment, and they create much more consumer spending, and especially discretionary, and therefore much more boost to the economy than the people on unemployment benefits do. It's simple math, folks. More money means more economy. Now, other studies have found that long-term jobless aid in places since 2008 didn't reduce the likelihood that laid-off workers would take available jobs. Now, and that's true as the closer you got to 2008 when there were no jobs. But as that time wore on, people got lazy and they stopped looking for jobs. And that's what happens when you cut their benefits. They would like to eat. They would like to, you know, maintain their house. And so they go out and find a job. I don't know how they conducted the study that extended benefits wouldn't reduce people's desire to take available jobs. So what you are saying is that there were definitely available jobs, but they weren't taking them anyway. So let's pay them. I talk to people all over the country. I do. Me personally, Splash. And when we get on this particular topic, and I don't get on it with everybody, and so this is not a study, of course, but there hasn't been a single one that didn't know somebody, some of them even know more than one somebody, who wasn't milking their unemployment for all that it was worth. But even that isn't conclusive research. It is an assumption, and it's a prediction based on my observations. This research to back up my assumptions and my predictions. Now, some commentators, both liberal and conservative, have taken issue with the paper's methodology. Nothing wrong with questioning the science of something. Using a different set of Labor Department data, Dean Baker of the Center of Economic Policy and Research found a smaller increase in employment in counties where the benefits cut was deeper. But there was still an increase. So even in their attempts to massage the numbers, there was still more hiring as a result of ending federal unemployment extensions, just not as much when they tweaked the numbers. So for some of the workers who benefits ended that December, hardship ensued, at least in the short term. Yeah, while they did what they should have done all along, got their acting gear and did a job search, things got more desperate for Charlie Walker of Phoenixville, Pennsylvania, for instance, before he got a new job last fall. Now, this is what always happens with the Smurfs, folks. As soon as the data doesn't start backing them up, they start pulling out single examples of people. And there's always a single example of something. But we're not talking about a single example when we're talking about sweeping policy for the entire country. So they pull out, they're now pulling out basically all the stops here. But remember, this particular guy, Charlie Walker of Phoenixville, Pennsylvania, before he got his new job last fall, he should have been looking for a job. He should have been trying to find one. He should have took a job that maybe he didn't want. We all have done that while we're looking for something better. But he got his job, right? So he is one of the 1.8 million workers that finally got up off his ass and did an actual job search. If you want to thank the Elmos for canceling your unemployment so you got off your fat ass and found a job, then the address is GOP.com. And Brian Krueger of Mount Horeb, see, we don't want to have just one example, we got to have two, of Horeb, Wisconsin, only got back to work in May of 2014. Again, one of the 1.8 million people. After going on food stamps and nearly losing his house, he doesn't see himself as part of a happy story about the economy improving. Really, Brian? Not a happy story? Did you lose your house or did you almost lose your house? Did you eat or did you not use that food stamps card? How many jobs did you turn down because you felt they were beneath you before you finally lost your extended benefits and got out there and took a job? This is the problem I have with this, folks, is in America, and you know, there's a little bit of truth to the jobs that most people, most Americans won't do. Now, when they're talking about that with the Mexicans, those jobs out there, Americans would do them. They just won't do them for less than minimum wage. I completely understand that. I completely understand that. But there's jobs out there when a guy loses his job as an engineer that are available. Okay, they're not going to pay what he made as an engineer, but they're going to pay more than unemployment. And you need to get out there and take that while you're continuing your job search, while the economy is starting to come back around so that the jobs you need, the jobs you want, the jobs you desire become available again without sitting on your ass at home, sulking. Ugh. Folks, I'm going to get a little personal now. Since 2008, not one, not two, but three jobs. And I replaced those jobs with six jobs. Did I file for unemployment? Yep. Did I collect it? 5 weeks worth, total. Because I got off my ass, I got out of bed every morning, I beat the street, I hunted and searched until I found a job. Several times I took a job I didn't really want. And then I kept searching for a better one. Many times I had two jobs at one time to just make sure that I made as much money as I made before because that's what I needed. Sometimes when I lost one of those jobs, I didn't even get unemployment because the other job was still there and I was still making money. Several times I took that job that I really didn't want, though. Now, we can't always get what we want. There is a lazy mentality out there that if I can't get a great job, then I'll just sit here on this couch drinking beer, eating Cheez-Its, and switching channels until a great job knocks on my door and hands me an application. I don't know how these people do it. I cannot live on unemployment. It is always lower than what you were making, and the more you make, the less employment amounts in comparison. I remember getting my first unemployment check. It was so small, I thought they made a mistake. But Brian, the dude that almost lost his house and had to go on food stamps, went on to say, "It's just a coincidence that I have work." Now, how do you coincidentally find a job 2 hours from your house that pays well enough to put you in a hotel 5 nights a week so that you don't have to commute home? This Brian guy found a job because his expiring unemployment extensions forced him to hunt high and low. That's how he found a job 2 hours from home, and he took what he could get because it beats the hell out of starving. Necessity, once again, is the mother of invention, and that is why I believe this study. And speaking of the mother of inventions, here we are inventing more efficient ways to extract oil from the ground along with lower fuel prices and better, more efficient ways to transport that oil. And then, in Mount Carbon, the fiery derailment of a train carrying crude oil in the West Virginia is one of three in the past year involving tank cars that already meet higher safety standards than what federal law requires, leading some to suggest even tougher requirements that industry representatives say would be prohibitively costly. I did a show on this not too long ago that included some information about safety of delivering Canadian oil by rail, something that we're doing more and more of as the XOL pipeline delays continue. The DOT 111 tank cars are prone to both derailment and explosion. They have resulted in countless accidents, resulting in explosion, environmental contaminations, and even loss of human life. Now, hundreds of families, and by the way, I'm getting this article is coming from the AP, hundreds of families were evacuated and nearby water treatment plants were temporarily shut down after cars derailed from a train carrying 3 million gallons of North Dakota crude Monday, shooting fireballs into the sky, leaking oil into the Kanawha River tributary, and burning down a house nearby. It was snowing at the time, but it's not yet clear if the weather was a factor. Now, at the this was a mild accident, folks. This could have been a lot worse. Had it been in a more populated area, then we could have seen the disaster like they saw in Lac Mégantic, Quebec, where 47 people were killed, burned. Horrible. The trains were similar in length, carrying the same amount of oil. The explosions were just as dramatic. The only difference was that in Lac Mégantic incident, that occurred right there in the middle of town, right in the middle of the village. Fortunately, the West Virginia derailment occurred on the edge of town. So, but here's the kicker. The train's tanks were the newer model, the safer model, the 1232s, designed during safety upgrades voluntarily adopted by the industry 4 years ago. The same models spilled oil and caught fire in Timmins, Ontario on Saturday, and last year in Lynchburg, Virginia. A series of ruptures and fires have prompted the administration of Barack Obama to consider requiring upgrades such as thicker tanks, shields to prevent tankers from crumpling, rollover protection, and electronic brakes that could make cars stop simultaneously rather than slamming into each other. Now, if approved, increased safety requirements now under White House review could phase out tens of thousands of older tanker cars being used to carry highly flammable liquids. But these are the newer cars. They were supposed to be safer. Let's face it, when trains derail, even at relatively moderate speeds, carrying hazmat materials, they will most likely explode. It really is that simple. Instead, Obama is trying to save the rail industry for oil transport while log jamming a much safer mode of transportation, pipelines. And there is the reason. There is a reason that Obama favors rail transport. So let's continue. This accident is another reminder of the need to improve safety and transport hazardous materials by rail, said Christopher Hart, acting chairman of the National Transportation Safety Board. Okay, so let's do it. Let's increase the safety. But industry officials say upgrading further from 1232 cars would be too costly. The Railway Supply Institute says an estimated $7 billion has already been spent to put 57,000 of these new cars into service. Okay, so it can't be done. We should do it, but it can't be done. We have billions invested in tank cars, Bob Greco, a senior official with the American Petroleum Institute, told the Associated Press in July. Every day, new modern 1232 tank cars, the newer, safer models, are coming into service. But as we have seen here, folks, in West Virginia, upgrading to the newer, safer 1232 cars seems to be pointless. Now, oil shipments by rail jumped from 9,500 carloads in 2008 to more than 435,000 in 2013. Now, 95,000 would be 10 times. This is 40 times of an increase, driven by a boom in the Bakken oil patch of North Dakota and Montana, where pipeline limitations, focus on that, pipeline limitations force 70% of crude to be moved by rail, according to American fuel and petrochemical manufacturers. Did you hear that? Pipeline limitations are responsible for this uptick spike, this spike in rail transport of oil and the corresponding spike in derailment disasters. So we're not just talking about the XL pipeline here. As coal-fired plants are shutting down, the Wall Street Journal reports that the XL crude oil pipeline, its political and regulatory snarls since then have emboldened resistance to at least 10 other pipeline projects in America, using Keystone XL as a template. National environmental groups are joining with local activists in a strategy aimed at prolonging government reviews of proposed pipeline routes and their environmental impact. I mean, when have we seen a governmental review take an entire two terms of a president? As a result, six oil and natural gas pipeline projects in North America costing a proposed $15 billion or more and stretching more than 3,400 miles have been delayed, a tally by Wall Street Journal shows. At least four other projects with a total investment of $25 billion and more than 5,100 miles in length are facing opposition but haven't yet been delayed. The snags could paralyze some projects for years, increase the cost of those that win approval, and kill some projects, though it hasn't happened yet. Kinder Morgan Inc. is delaying the $4.8 billion 617-mile expansion of its Trans Mountain pipeline for at least 6 months while the Houston company works on changes to the route that executives hope will face less opposition than originally proposed. Now, delays are adding to the push to move oil by rail. That's from Robert Johnston. He's the chief executive of Eurasia Group, an independent political analysis firm. Oil-carrying trains are considered less safe than pipelines by many analysts and government officials. Oil shipments by rail have increased nearly threefold since 2008. Well, the numbers I just gave you, they were much more than threefold. The downside, trains hauling Bakken region oil have been involved in major accidents in Virginia, North Carolina, Oklahoma, Alabama, and Canada, where 47 people, as you know, were killed by an explosive derailment in 2013 in Lac-Mégantic, Quebec. Reports of leaks and other oil releases from tank cars are up as well, from 12 in 2008 to 186 last year, according to the Department of Transportation records reviewed by the Associated Press. And a pretty big downside it is. So why this rush to support the transport of oil by rail and the continual delay of a much safer mode of transport in pipelines? We're almost there, folks. Almost there. Just last Saturday, 2 days before the West Virginia wreck, 29 cars of a 100-car Canadian National Railway train carrying diluted bitumen crude, derailed in a remote area 50 miles south of Timmins, Ontario, spilling oil and catching fire. That train was headed to Alberta from eastern Canada. Now, the train Monday was bound for an oil shipping depot in Yorktown, Virginia, along with the same route where the three tanker cars plunged into the James River in Lynchburg, Virginia, prompting an evacuation last year. Now, the train derailed near unincorporated Mount Carbon just after passing through Montgomery, a town of 1946, on a stretch where the rail wound past businesses and homes crowded between the water and the steep tree-covered hills. All but two trains of the 109 cars were tank cars, and 26 of them left the tracks. Now, the fire crews had little choice but to let tanks burn themselves out, each carrying up to 30,000 each carrying up to 30,000 gallons of crude. Oil cars were still burning, as they oil cars were still burning. They were still burning by Tuesday evening. One person, the owner of the destroyed home, was treated for smoke inhalation, but no other injuries were reported, according to the train company CSX. Now, I want you guys to remember that, folks. CSX. The two-person crew, an engineer conductor, managed to decouple the train's engines from the wreck behind it and walked away unharmed. I like that. Every man for himself. So going down with the ship doesn't apply to trains, I guess. A good thing for those guys. The NTSB said that the investigators will compare this wreck to others, including Lynchburg and the one near Castleton, North Dakota, when a Bakken crude train created a huge fireball that forced the evacuation of a farming town. No cause has been determined, said CSX. Remember that, folks, CSX. Regional Vice President Randy Cheatham said. He said that the tracks had been inspected just 3 days before the wreck. Now, they'll look at the train handling, they'll look at the tracks, they'll look at the cars, but until they get in there and do their investigation, it's unwise to do any type of speculation, he said. Now, by Tuesday evening, power crews were restoring electricity, water treatment plants were going back online, and most of the local residents were back home. Now, initial tests showed no crude near water plants intake points, State Environmental Protection spokeswoman Kelly Gillenwater said. What a name for an environmentalist. What a name for environmentalists. State officials do have some say over rail safety. Railroads are required by federal order to tell state emergency officials where trains carrying crude are traveling. CSX and other railroads, remember that, folks, CSX and other railroads called this information proprietary. But more than 20 states reject the industry's argument, informing the public as well as first responders about crude moving through their communities. And there is a real problem with rail transport. Aside from the fact that derailments in even the most remote areas cause major environmental problems, all rails lead through populated areas from small communities to big cities. And that's because the primary cargo of our train system used to be people. Pipelines, on the other hand, can be routed around communities. They are safer to the environment and to people. So why is the Obama administration moving to make rail transport of oil more safe, even though the rail companies say it's too costly and nearly impossible to make them safer, while delaying the safer pipelines for years? Two words, folks, Warren Buffett. Two more words for you, Berkshire Hathaway. The Oracle of Omaha is a big supporter of Obama and just so happens to own major stakes in three of the four major railway companies in North America, including CSX. Follow the money, folks. Follow the money. Meanwhile, environmentalists, in their never-ending quest to attack oil, ignore the fact that pipeline transport is safer both to the environment and to people, choosing instead to block the safer pipelines. Why? Because they are more efficient and bring oil to its necessary destination at lower prices. Lower. Remember, for the environmentalist dream to occur, alternative energy sources in a world without oil. Oil prices have to be excruciatingly high, otherwise alternative energy sources cannot compete. So these environmentalists abandon their core conviction, protect the environment, to achieve their ultimate political goal, kill oil, putting the environment and people in more and more peril, all the while lining the pockets of Warren Edward Buffett. They truly do put the mental in environmentalist. Well, that's a wrap for tonight's show, folks. And we are going to be back here next week on Monday night. That's at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Check the website to see what's up for Monday night's show, 1111broadcasting.com. I hope you'll join us. And until next week, have a great weekend, and by all means, do what you love and love what you do. Good night, everybody.